kind of get the local view, variety of issues. He's our local columnist for the Register Guard. You can see what he's up to on the cover of the sports section on Twitter. It's at Austin Meek RG. Austin, happy Tuesday. How's it going?
Not too bad. The first day of the college football off season is always kind of a tough day for me, and I'm also still getting over the Chiefs blowing that 18-point lead to the Titans on Saturday, but otherwise I'm okay.
Yeah, I'm going to get to that, believe me. But
I knew you would.
When you sit in a town like Oregon, and we know what rules, Duck fans, after the events of last night, somehow made it all about Oregon for not offering a scholarship to this Tua kid who idolized Mariota. He wanted to come here. So what have you heard about the recruiting process that landed him there? And, you know, are fans overreacting, or should they be a little concerned that he, I guess, got away?
Well, look, after watching that game last night, I think you'd have to say this could go down as one of the all-time recruiting misses for Oregon. Because like you said, this kid, he wanted to come here. He went to Marcus Mariota's high school, grew up idolizing Mariota. For whatever reason, Oregon just was kind of lukewarm on this kid. You know, they had another quarterback committed, and by the time Oregon really started to recruit him, he was already set on going to Alabama. Look, we've only seen him play one half of football, and it certainly was not flawless. There were some plays last night when you could tell he was a freshman playing his first game. But to play his first game in a national championship game and rally his team from down 13-0 at halftime to throw the game-winning pass in overtime, not a bad way to start your career.
Yeah.
I think you'll take that.
You know, it cracks me up. I keep hearing how he idolized Mariota growing up. Like, you know, Mariota's 22, 23 years older than him. Was he like 5 or 6 years older than him? I don't know. I think we live in a very melodramatic society. As for the game itself, the first guy on Twitter I saw point this out was Aaron Fentress. Then I watched the replay like 5, 6 times. So if you had to make a bet on the game tying touchdown with just under 4 minutes to go that went to Calvin Ridley, you think this kid was throwing it up for grabs out of desperation on fourth down and got lucky? Or did he actually see Ridley breaking free to his left?
Oh, he was totally throwing it up for grabs. I mean, it was like, you know, you saw that interception he threw. There was nobody on that one. I mean, he literally just chucked it in the middle of three different defenders on the interception. He was doing the same thing there. You know, he did have a man in the back of the end zone. And I'll say this, was it Harris that was in the back of the end zone?
Yeah.
If Ridley doesn't step in front and catch that pass, I'm pretty sure there's a penalty on Georgia, because the Georgia defender was taking him out in the back of the end zone. I think it would have been pass interference if Ridley hadn't caught it. So it was kind of a moot point. But yeah, totally a lucky throw.
You know, for the record, and you can check our station Twitter to take part in the poll. It was a prayer. Talk with Austin Meek of the Register Guard. So your Sunday piece was about former Bama assistant, now Duck head coach, Mario Cristobal. So I really didn't know the backstory. So he was fired from Florida International. I know a lot of people thought he got a raw deal. So he was not immediately ticketed for Alabama, I guess. He was about to return to his alma mater. What happened there?
Yeah, he'd already accepted a job as the tight ends coach at Miami. That was when Al Golden was there.
Right.
And he was there for about 6 weeks, I think, and then Saban called and offered him the offensive line job at Alabama, and he just felt like, you know, the chance to learn from Saban, to get that head coaching PhD, as he put it, would be really valuable. And, you know, if the choice is Al Golden or Nick Saban, I think that's probably a pretty smart decision on his part. But, he really used that time at Alabama to set himself up to be a head coach again. He went as far as to request the title of assistant head coach, just to show that that's what he was there to do. He was there to learn from Nick Saban.
talking with Austin Meek of the Register Guard. Now, like all coaches, he won't fix what's not broken. He wants to leave his imprint. And during some of Oregon's better years, it always seemed like they were in a little better shape than a lot of other teams. And, you know, a lot of credit to the strength and conditioning coach then, Jim Radcliffe. So what did you learn about this fourth quarter program and maybe where they are in a process to hire a new conditioning coach that can implement this for Cristobal?
Well, it sounds like they're close on the strength coach. And I know that Mario Cristobal thinks very highly of Scott Cochran, who's the guy at Alabama. I won't be surprised at all if they end up hiring somebody who's got some connection to that, you know, somebody who sort of comes from that same school of thought. The fourth quarter program is something that Nick Saban developed when he was with Don James back 40-some years ago.
Wow.
And Alabama has used it ever since, and it's really kind of the backbone of what they do to build their team. So Mario Cristobal is really going to model Oregon after that. It's going to be different. Yeah, I think there are quite a few things that are going to be pretty similar from what Oregon did with Willie Taggart, but that's one of the things that's going to be different. That's going to be Mario's own way of doing it.
I want to hit on this, I don't know, mess between ESPN, some NBA coaches over this crazy coverage of LeVar Ball and his Lithuania. I get a little nervous when outsiders tell media what to write or give time to, but he's not a reporter, a coach, a player, or anything. He's the parent of an athlete. You heard Steve Kerr call it, I guess, the Kardashianing of the sports media. What's your take on the attention this guy gets and maybe the reaction to it?
Yeah, look, I'm as sick of LeVar Ball as anybody. I like Jeff Goodman. I had to unfollow Jeff Goodman on Twitter today because I didn't want to read the updates anymore. Props to ESPN, I guess, for having the budget to send somebody to Lithuania. That probably could have paid for a few people who got laid off last year to keep their jobs. I am totally sick of all things LeVar Ball. That being said, I also don't think the answer is to pull credentials from people who interview the guy. Look, that's part of having a free press is, you know, journalists have the right to interview whoever they want, and ultimately it's the readers who determine if there's demand for that. You know, somebody must be clicking on those LeVar Ball stories, because otherwise ESPN wouldn't send somebody over there. So rather than pulling credentials, I think maybe the solution is, hey, if you're sick of it, don't click on it. Don't engage with it. Don't read it. Don't tweet about it. ESPN eventually will get the message that people just don't care about this anymore. I don't think that the NBA can dictate who people interview. And I know they tried to play the card that, you know, ESPN is our league partner and we cooperate with ESPN on the broadcasts and stuff. That doesn't mean you get to dictate journalistically how ESPN does its job. But, you know, from my perspective, journalistically, I don't see much value in talking about LeVar Ball.
You know, I know how subjective this is, but for those who say that he draws attention, like when they covered Tebow playing A-ball, or, you know, the 80 million stories when Favre might come out of retirement, is it any logic to say that might be lazy reporting to show the car wreck? Is there any logic to, would the average fan seek information on these sensationalistic stories if they weren't hit over the head with it?
Well, you know, there's kind of a lowest common denominator factor there where, you know, it's easy to cover Tebow. It's easy to cover LeVar Ball because you know that there are people who are going to click on it. The harder thing to do, but maybe the better thing to do, is to push the kind of journalism that maybe people, you know, wouldn't necessarily just automatically click on it, but if you can pull them into it, then they realize that there's something better there. And I'll give ESPN some credit because they do that from time to time, and they do it really well. You know, ESPN has done some stories that on the surface of it, maybe, you know, it wouldn't interest you, but then you get into it and you realize, wow, this is really interesting. It's really well done. Now, that's the kind of stuff I'd like to see. and it, you know, it can be hard to do, and you have to sell people on it a little bit. But the payoff is, you know, you end up doing smarter stuff than just the typical clickbait.
So talk up to your audience rather than down.
Yeah, like you do. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. my theory of trying to extend outside the lines to crunch time and sports talk. we continue with Austin Meek of the Register Guard. You mentioned it. I'd be remiss if I didn't talk some Titans Chiefs. Last week we had the tortured fan conversation, and certainly KC surfaced. And that was pre-meltdown number infinity since they won the fourth Super Bowl. I got a laugh. I saw on Twitter, you, even as a Chiefs fan, had an appreciation for Mariota's self-TD pass. Then I saw later on, the thrill was gone.
Yeah, you know, at the time, I think it was 21-3, and Mariota had that, you know, that crazy touchdown where it got batted back to him. He catches it and scores. I think I made it 21-10. So at that point, I'm thinking, well, okay, 21-10. Chiefs are still going to win. I can laugh about this. Funny, fluky play, whatever. By the time the Titans took the lead, I was completely furious about that totally garbage, bogus touchdown that got the Titans back in the game. Ridiculous play. Should not have counted. Needless to say, I was not feeling very good about it by the end.
Yeah, why did they sign Darrelle Revis in the first place? Let's wrap with last Friday's hardwood civil war, bad performance by the Ducks. I guess for this time of year, kind of a rare step back for a Dana Altman team. But let's look at the Oregon State side, because it's kind of a fascinating story. They end the 26-year Big Dance drought 2 years ago, then have their worst season in two decades last year. You were there, the reaction, what you saw. How big a win was that for Wayne Tinkle and the Beavs?
Well, it was, to me, the best moment Oregon State has had since they made the tournament a couple years ago. Last year, it just, you know, it was a nightmare from start to finish. Practically no redeeming qualities from last season. So they, you know, it's been a long haul for them. They've had to go through some stuff now to get to this point. So I think it was a really gratifying night for Oregon State and for those players, because most of their team was there last year. You know, yep. The core of that team went through that 5-27 season last year. You know what? They stuck together. They got through it. They're not great this year. They're probably not going to make the NCAA tournament, but they're better. And so for the guys who suffered through that, there should be some real satisfaction in coming back and beating a team that was in the Final Four last year. You know, that's progress for Oregon State. You know, they're still a ways away. Like I said, they're not great. But to be able to beat your rival that was in the Final Four last year, I think that's, you know, that's pretty good compared to where they've been.
Well, if they came out worse than last year, next year they'd be in the Big Sky. But
yeah.
Anyway, Austin Meek, always appreciate you getting us started on a Tuesday. At Austin Meek RG on Twitter, registerguard.com, or in the sports section on the cover. Austin, thanks a lot. You have a great week.
All right, you too, Steve. Thanks.
Take it easy.